Hey listeners, Shrill Collective here. Just a heads up that The Rat King contains adult content, including descriptions and instances of stalking and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Resources for these issues can be found in the show notes and at the end of the episode. Please enjoy The Rat King.
Welcome, everybody. This is The Rat King. Part 7, Escape from the Garden. We check frequently. And within 2 weeks, Phoebus's image is featured on the Capital Violence Wanted pages of the FBI website. The same pages we've been exhaustively perusing. A lot of the images are of unidentified suspects, just the Bureau fishing for tips. Phoebus is identified, though, by name. It's him, for sure. This means a few things. First, he's in violation of his parole. Second, he's made it to the East Coast, as Daphne fears. Third, he's unaccounted for. Like with every step of this story, Daphne is not of a single mind regarding what she should do. She goes back and forth a lot. In the meantime, Nibby arranges a hotel for Daphne and her family. Better safe than sorry.
How's the hotel?
Depressing. It's like one of those efficiency things with, like, a little kitchenette.
No fancy room service. How's Kay? How are the kids?
I don't know. The kids are having fun. Nothing to report, really. Next question.
Okay. I feel like I have to ask. Did you identify Phoebus to the FBI?
It was not me, no. But I do know who did.
Daphne follows a whim, and that whim pays off. Believe it or not, it was Phoebus' aunt who turns him in. The same aunt he was living with in Los Angeles in the early 2000s, when he and Daphne had those several odd run-ins.
This is the same aunt whose grocery list consisted of... what was it?
Chicken cutlets, flavored seltzer, and of course, Kleenex.
This is just fascinating to me. How do you get in touch with her?
So, remember Phoebus gave me her number at the grocery store? I ended up throwing it in a box full of random stuff. Correspondences, important receipts, addresses, keepsakes. You know how that stuff builds up?
Sure, but you don't still have those things now. I mean, this is a long time ago.
I did keep some of it. Like the sentimental stuff.
So why do you keep this random number?
Well, I told Phoebus I didn't have a phone, so I'd fished around in my bag for something to write his number on. And that something happened to be a concert stub from the Los Angeles Philharmonic at the Hollywood Bowl.
And you keep all your concert stubs?
Yes, I am that person.
But doesn't the aunt move away?
She lives in Arizona now. But I searched the original phone number plus previous addresses, and she popped right up with a Hollywood Street address.
Okay, so now you have the address of the L.A. house. But how does that help if Phoebus's aunt doesn't live in L.A. anymore?
Well, so then I searched the street address plus phone number and got the current residence landline, and I called. They rent the house directly from Phoebus's aunt, and voila, they gave me her number. I told her I thought her nephew was involved in the Capitol attack. Do you know what she said to me? No shit, Sherlock.
Hello, is this Rita?
I am, yes. Is this the reporter?
Podcaster. Nice to meet you.
Well, same thing.
This is Rita. She shares a last name with Phoebus, so we'll just leave it there. She currently resides in Sedona, Arizona.
So what tipped you off that your nephew is part of the Capitol invasion?
Oh, that was a foregone conclusion. He's got some real absurd ideas.
Like what?
I don't want to repeat those things. Ideas that are not based in reality. How about that? He tried to come stay with me to oversee the ballot count.
The Arizona ballot count?
That one.
Just for clarity, because woefully, recent events actually demand clarity on this topic, Rita is referring to the official November 2020 ballot count conducted by the actual Arizona Board of Elections, not the highly suspect fringe audit, which was subsequently conducted by a private firm called the Cyber Ninjas.
If he ever made it to Arizona, your guess is as good as mine. Did he stay with me? Absolutely not. He already drove me out of one house.
You're saying you left Los Angeles to get away from your nephew?
I tried to get him to move out, but he wouldn't leave. And I was starting to be afraid of him. Look, I'm not a stickler about the law. For the most part, I find laws pretty arbitrary. But I know, and he is not a well person.
How do you mean?
You probably know the answer to that. He was stalking your friend, for heaven's sake.
Are you talking about Daphne?
Yeah, the forest girl or whatever.
Why do you call her forest girl?
That's what he called her. She's the one that contacted me the other day, correct? She worked at the bookstore on Franklin Avenue in Hollywood back in 2001, 2, 3, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, back in L.A., he had a whole bunch of pictures of her taken through the front windows of that store or walking to and from work. He had them all over the wall in his room.
Oh, I don't think she knows that.
Maybe she should.
Does your nephew ever say anything to you about her?
Sure. He thought they were a couple. That was obvious BS. Anyone could see from the pictures he was stalking her. I asked why he didn't have any pictures of them together or outside her job. He looked at me a long time, dead silent, kind of calculating. I remember thinking, is he going to hit me? Can you believe that? I actually thought that. Then he just went to his room and closed the door.
Does he bring it up again?
Not a peep. Next time I went in there, the pictures were gone. Maybe I should have just called the police, but it's complicated with family.
But it seems Rita does end up calling the police on Phoebus only 2 decades later. And it's still complicated with family. But people change their minds, contexts change, and people can and do change also.
I just put the house up for rent and told him I was ready for a change. He didn't have any money, so he moved back to Oregon. And I headed to the vortexes of Sedona. Fresh energy, fresh start.
We've heard that one before. Fresh energy, fresh start. I play the interview for Daphne, even though I wish I didn't have to.
Yeah, I worked at the bookstore during that time. It was my first job in LA.
And just to be very clear, the bookstore, the white rats in your apartment, the running into Phoebus 3 different times, this is all in the same period.
Yes.
On the one hand, this all took place about 20 years ago, which neutralizes the threat in some way. But the other hand is now holding a dynamic set of problems. It's as if all the worst-case scenario versions of Phoebus that seemed either paranoid or extreme to Daphne before are all gaining validation. He's been engaging the fantasy for a long time. His mythological erotomania is not an artistic whim of late. It's been a grounding principle of his obsession since the beginning. And let's not forget, Phoebus is now on the East Coast. He knows Daphne lives in Brooklyn. He knows she has kids. He's a fugitive and likely desperate. Time is not on our side.
So what do you want to do?
It's a mean question. She wants to do yoga, watch a movie, play with her kids, read a book, visit her parents, take a fucking bath. What will Daphne do? That's the question. The first thing she does is forward my calls for an entire day. While she takes stock of things, I call Nibby and ask her to get a little more intel on Phoebus.
So, again, Daphne needs to ask me to do this. I'm not poking around without her consent.
Technically, he's a fugitive, so isn't he free game?
That's not the point. I'm trying to help a friend. If my friend doesn't want this help, I would never in a million years force it on her. Consent, consent, consent.
Lashes from Nibby. Check.
Can I ask you something else, not about Daphne?
Quickly.
Are any of your clients capital invaders?
You mean, are any of my clients allegedly capital invaders? Tell Daphne to call me if she needs a hand. Bless you and goodbye.
When Daphne does call me back, I tell her what Nibby says and repeat her admonishment about consent, which seems to cheer her up a little. I realize Nibby, even in her hard-as-nails packaging, is the one person in all of this, and unfortunately that includes me, and even Kay, who has actually respected Daphne's boundaries all along. She's managed to hit that sweet note. Available, but not overbearing. Respectful, but not indifferent. As much as Daphne wants to pull down the blackout shades in her hotel room windows and forget everything, Nibby's sweet note is effective, and Daphne finally agrees to accept her help. Nibby immediately gets to work contacting a colleague at the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office in Portland. As we wait for those details to flesh out, I get a phone call, a most surprising phone call, from Gary. He leaves a message saying he wants to meet us, both of us, me and Daphne.
So what do you make of this?
I don't know what to make of it. I mean, as memorable as Gary was, I only met him once. Why does he want to see me?
I give Gary a call. And want to hear something crazy? Gary is back at the Adelphi Street apartment. Gary is triumphant and isn't shy with the details. Seems like he gets a bee in his bonnet after I interview him. All the righteous indignation surrounding his eviction from the Adelphi house that he's been so far too enlightened to process finally catches up to him. He's distracted and irritable at the food co-op. His art is suffering. He goes into a short but intensive period of reflection. Jade was his friend, and she has tricked him. Even though he's too kind-hearted to admit it at first, he realizes it now. She sacrificed him. And after she sacrificed him, she never checked on him. Gary reflects and reflects, and he wonders what this thing is that he's feeling. It's so uncomfortable, so icky. And he realizes, to his horror, that the strange emotion he's feeling is anger. One thing about Gary is that he views anger as the absolute worst impediment a person can run up against. So he begins to think of ways around it. And after much thought, and even more reflection, Gary finally does something totally brave and totally left field. He contacts Jade. He goes to some trouble to find her. As we've all learned, she is an elusive one. But when he does, well.
I just spilled my guts out to her. I told her how challenging it was for me after I moved out. And how I was houseless, on and off for years. I mean, I really fell into some hard times. I had some scary experiences. It took a long time for me to admit that I was tricked and misused.
How does Jade react?
She really listened.
What does she say?
It was very unexpected. She started sharing with me too. It sounds like the pandemic had been really hard for her.
Sadly, Jade tells Gary that her best friend died of COVID early on, and she's been extremely lonely. She's just lost the garden floor tenant on Adelphi, and Vic and Presley bail on her for something bigger and better and cheaper. The top floor tenant isn't paying, and there's been a moratorium on evictions in New York. And something about these millennials she's dealing with now makes her terribly uneasy. They don't appear at all beholden to imaginary terms or deals. They seem to know their rights. When she does find tenants to replace Vic and Presley, these new tenants insist on contacting Jade by email. And they want her to fix things that break and clean shared spaces, like the upstairs hallways and the front stoop. Jade needs someone like Gary, someone dependable, someone who will do the light repairs.
And so she asked me to move back, and I accepted.
I've never heard Gary sound like this. He sounds genuinely happy. But
I have some mail for Daphne. That's why I was calling.
Oh, okay.
It's just one letter from someone named...
I have a mail forwarding service. If Gary got it at the Adelphi apartment, that means it didn't go through USPS.
It could be UPS or FedEx.
Or he could have just put it there himself.
We don't know if it will be a drawing or a message or an ear. But we know there's a good chance it was placed there in person by Phoebus. That a matter of days ago, he was standing in our city. And to make matters, predictable, Daphne reports a rat has nested in the engine of her car, but gotten stuck trying to get out. It perished hanging from underneath the bumper. I'm horrified and impressed to hear she keeps driving the car anyway. But what should she do? She's broke. It's COVID. She doesn't know how to take the bumper off. I get to see the rat myself when she picks me up the next day. Yes, there it is. The limp tail and haunches just dangling there, vibrating slightly with the hum of the engine.
Have you checked your engine? I know someone whose car actually caught fire after rats got under his hood and chewed up all the wiring.
Kay pulled out a couple of chicken bones, but they hadn't done any real damage. We try to move it a lot.
We're driving with masks on, windows open, and Daphne's got her arm out the window, like it's July in an old pickup truck. Everything is nostalgic during COVID, and the weather is actually fair for February. We've arranged to get the letter from Gary. I don't know why Daphne insists on going there to get it. Maybe it's the apartment's indefinable magnetism calling to her. It feels a little foolhardy, a little Nancy Drew, but we're doing it. We're on our way to get the letter with a giant dead rat dangling from the bumper like a Mad Maxian ornament.
Can I turn on the radio? My heart is in my throat.
We park two blocks away. Daphne pulls a hood over her head. Between the gloves, the hood, the mask, she could be anyone. We turn onto Adelphi Street. I call Gary ahead so he can let us in through the parlor floor entrance, for discretion. There's a cedar shed outside Gary's gate now, housing the trash cans. Gary waves us up the stoop, holding the door open for us. Same old Gary, but like winter Gary. Sherpa slippers, drop crotch sweatpants, Patagonia fleece, partially unzipped, no underlayer, bandana face mask. Except now he's balding, so he's taken all his hair down to about a quarter of an inch. The greetings are awkward, as could be expected. Gary leads us down a dingy back stairwell to the garden floor. The hallway is lined with Gary's most recent work. He's done a collection of small wooden figures, mostly animals, and a series of spears which he's mounted on the brick wall.
The wood is something new I'm trying. There's been so much wind this winter. I've been finding huge branches all over. Whittling has been a lifesaver.
What about your cement art?
Oh, well, cement is so heavy.
A truer word was never spoken.
I think maybe we can sit outside since it's mild.
Sure.
We're ushered through the apartment to the backyard. And let me tell you, it is wild walking through this space. I've never seen it in person before, yet a part of me has basically lived here for the past year or so. Regardless of Gary's strange decor, I just want to say, for the record, I see it. I get it. This is a special place. And when we cross the threshold into the backyard, my eye lands on that Japanese maple, leafless in this late winter, and I hear her life song. Gary brings us out a little tray of tea and some gluten-free wafer things. We sit together, several feet apart from each other, and take down our masks. Gary glances at Daphne a few times. I can't quite put my finger on the tone of his expression. Is it concern? Is it sadness? I've called him ahead of this visit and given him some backstory on Daphne's situation with Phoebus. He is quiet on the phone, and I can tell he's deeply affected by the story. But Gary is one of those people. An open heart, a sponge, a wound. He produces the letter from the pocket of his fleece and passes it to Daphne with his own special brand of bashful ceremony.
Thanks.
The whole secret of existence is to have no fear. That's Buddha.
Yeah, thanks.
Daphne turns the letter over in her hand. There's Phoebus's penmanship, Daphne's name, all four parts. She sees the return to sender, his name, all three parts. No return address, no postage. This is the letter Daphne has been dreading for years. The one without any postmarks. The one that is hand-delivered.
It's light.
Daphne's wearing rubber gloves, and she carefully slits the top edge of the letter with the blade from her small Swiss Army knife. It's a far cry from the haphazard way she used to regard these letters, spilling coffee on them, using the margins for scrap. She parts the envelope. And then...
What the fuck?
What?
It's empty.
What?
It's fucking empty.
I look. It is empty. No drawings, no user instructions, no clues or hints. Just a very simple prod. I am here. A thought ripples through me. Is this Phoebus's game? Show how exceptional his power is by terrorizing with so little effort. It is absolutely chilling, and suddenly I feel him in every window, in every passing cloud. Daphne looks like she's seen a ghost, and who can blame her? This empty envelope is a real mindfuck.
Can we show you the wanted pictures, just in case you see him?
Oh, that's not what I expected. Oh, he looks...
What?
I don't know, nothing. He looks ordinary, that's all.
If you see him, call the police.
And that's it. That's all Daphne says, really. Gary gives us every assurance that he will be on the lookout for Phoebus. He keeps putting his hands in the prayer position when he addresses Daphne. A point of deference, a point of grace, an apology for something. For men of all shapes and sizes, I still can't tell. The sun has passed the rooftops, and it's starting to feel like February again. Daphne and I exit from the parlor floor. We barely speak as we walk to Green Avenue. The neighborhood is pretty bustling for a COVID Sunday. People are really starting to get over it. I'm looking for Phoebus everywhere, in every face. This must be how Daphne always feels. Here's Nibby.
What we know. Alvin is still not reported back to his PO, nor is he in federal custody. I have some information about his previous offenses. Should we talk about that?
Please.
The more recent charges are for theft and breaking and entering, and destruction of property. Apparently a convenience store was closing for the night and kicked the door in. He stole wine coolers and menaced the attendant.
So when he was released last year because of COVID, he was doing a bid for these charges?
Correct. Now, the 2009 assault charge is a little different. This was a Class C felony, but he was also being charged with second-degree kidnapping. From what you'll hear, this was a rather disturbing incident involving an elderly man.
Oh, no.
I should add, there was an additional animal abuse charge, which is oddball, and that was dropped before the hearing. Should I send it to you now?
Now is great, please. So, I'm here with Daphne. Nibby has just sent us a deposition taken by Phoebus's kidnapping and assault victim in Portland, Oregon. We'll be bleeping out all the names as usual. So, this is an elderly man. Do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Okay. Sworn statement. Sworn statement. I hired to clear out and repair our outdoor storage shed, put in new shelves, patch up the holes, and get rid of the rats nesting there. The work took longer than we expected. He stayed late most nights, but he did a good job. I tried to pay him with a check. He said he needed cash, so would come back the next day. Later that night, I heard a loud squealing. I went outside. It was very dark, and I turned on a flashlight. The shed was empty, but the squealing was very loud. It sounded like rats. I saw a notch in the floorboard and pulled it up. I found 6 rats all twisted together in a ball.
A rat king.
I called our neighbor, a veterinarian. He said it looked like someone had glued them together by the tail and left them to starve under the floor of the shed. When came back for his money, I confronted him about what he had done. He struck my head and pushed me back into the shed and locked me in. I fell and suffered injuries to my head and hand. I was trapped for 12 hours before Jim came back around and heard me calling. I suffered a minor stroke and have 2 broken bones in my hand.
Jesus.
And he wasn't charged for the animal abuse?
No. Nibby says that charge got dropped. I guess people aren't that sympathetic to rats.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Obviously, our minds are just racing. Did Phoebus make the Rat King under Adelphi Street too? Were those happy sunrise texts actually sent from New York all along? Was he here, seeing Daphne when she couldn't see him? It's almost too terrible to think about. Like the scene in Silence of the Lambs, when Clarice is stumbling around in James Gum's house, and he's watching her the entire time from an inch away, mapping out the contours of her face. But this version doesn't line up either.
So, Phoebus doesn't miss a single meeting with his PO during the time he gets released in May 2013.
No, it seems like he was in Oregon that whole time. And according to some of the stuff Nibby sent over, he entered a mandated sober living house in June.
Right.
The day after, that squirrel ran into my window.
So what are you thinking?
I don't know what to think. At this point, I feel like the whole universe is fucking gaslighting me. He could have found me easily, many times. He's a game player. A tormentor. Even if he is delusional and thinks our relationship meant more than it did, he is actively indulging that delusion. Maybe he is actually ill. Maybe he does have substance abuse issues, but he's also a terrorist. Period. I want to take him down.
I've heard people say anger is a useless emotion. But maybe not. Maybe. Like it was for Gary. Anger is the actual antidote to all of Daphne's paralysis and hesitation. And maybe, just maybe, Phoebus has finally overplayed his hand. Late the next night, on Adelphi Street, Gary hears a rustling outside his front window.
Can you tell us what happened?
Sorry, this is...
Do you want to call back later?
No. It's been a lot. I'm sorry. I'm ready. It was just after 2 a.m, but I was still awake. I heard the sound again. So I crept into the hallway and looked out the peephole. And I saw a figure, hunched over, reaching through the gate, trying to turn the latch. If you reach your arm in a certain way, you can get through the bars, but it's a hard angle.
But it works?
Yeah. He got the gate open right as I opened the inner door. So we were face to face. Your guy. Phoebus, I guess you call him.
Gary says Phoebus is visibly intoxicated, and after a brief verbal exchange, the two enter into a fray. Phoebus knocks Gary backward into the apartment. Gary starts screaming, awakening Eloise, or Esther, who races down the stairs of her own brownstone and enters the building. By this time, Phoebus has gotten the better of Gary and appears to be wringing his neck. I do not get to talk to Esther. She declines my request for an interview. But according to Gary's account, Esther now does something extraordinary. She grabs one of Gary's spears off the wall and brings it down straight through the top of Phoebus's right foot, effectively pinning him in place. Phoebus wails in understandable agony, awakening even more neighbors, and Gary scrambles free, panting and stumbling. It is Eloise, or Esther, that calls 911. It is this woman, who Daphne had once believed her opponent, who stops Phoebus in his tracks. She and Gary wait outside together by the new cedar garbage shed. More neighbors gather as Phoebus howls from inside the house, unable to move his foot even a millimeter in any direction. Phoebus is, dare I say, rooted to the ground like a tree when the ambulance and the police arrive to the scene. And if there is any such thing as poetic justice, this, maybe, is an example of it.
Hey. How are you?
Okay. I turned over all my Phoebus stuff to the detective. That felt weird. I've never, participated in prosecuting someone.
You avoided it for a long time.
Yeah. But he's not being charged with stalking me. He's being charged with breaking and entering into Gary's apartment and aggravated assault and whatever the hell he did at the Capitol, I guess. Eventually.
I'm sorry. I wish I could say I'm surprised.
Over the next few weeks, Daphne and I text once in a while. We're both kind of exhausted. It's like guilt by association. The whole affair has been so ugly, so low. We're like too tainted to hang out with each other. I still track Phoebus, of course. Old habits. His arrest isn't broadly publicized because he didn't conduct himself in the Capitol with a whole lot of special flourish, like some of the others did. Maybe if people knew some of the stuff we know, he'd attract more media attention. Daphne and I meet for the last time in April 2021. It's starting to be springtime in New York. Spring is the special, private secret New Yorkers share. One we keep tucked with us all winter, like a poorly planned surprise party to which every single one of us is the eventual, unsurprised guest of honor. Thinking back to Daphne's 2013 monologue, yeah, Mother Nature is so in on it. It's a goddamn spectacle. Daphne and I are sitting in Prospect Park. Her kids are playing about 30 feet from us. It's been a while since Daphne and I have spoken. She's just celebrated her 41st birthday, which passes, like all things COVID, with little fanfare.
I finally talked to Gary. That was interesting.
I glance at Daphne. She doesn't have a great poker face.
What would you think if I told you Gary already knew Phoebus?
Are you kidding me? How?
Yep. I guess he ended up with one of Phoebus's letters back when I used to leave his mail under the gate for him. He opened it. He read it. He sent the letter back to Phoebus with a letter of his own explaining the mix-up.
Instead of just returning the letter to you, why?
Apparently that was Vic's idea. I guess he was more pissed about Jade running the apartment than he let on. They wanted to fuck with me. They could tell by the letter that Phoebus was crazy. I guess they just didn't know how much.
So all that time, when Daphne thinks Phoebus doesn't know her address, of course he actually does. It was so easy to find. Of course he has it. He's sending the letters weird places like Ellie's family home and Daphne's parents' house because he's a game player. And because he's manipulative enough to see clear value in casting himself as inept, harmless. But he knows exactly where she is. And if he didn't before, Gary tells him.
But it started getting out of hand for Gary long after Vic lost interest in the gag. He and Phoebus started communicating more regularly, commiserating over their grievances. Phoebus groomed Gary pretty effectively, got him performing tasks, you know, carrying out the harassment Phoebus couldn't execute from across the country.
I feel sick. I'm thinking about what tasks Daphne means. All the things I couldn't square up with Phoebus's parole status in 2013. It is Gary coming by the house, going through the trash, ramping up the rat problem. With a careless assist from Presley and Vic, who go out of their way to knock off trash can lids and overfill the cans. Yes, it is Gary who leaves the dead rat and collects Daphne's discarded items, collects Daphne's hair. He tells me in that first interview that he's been under that house. Now I understand his caginess, his hesitancy with the details, his perfect memory that suddenly gets cloudy.
You know what this means, right? Gary made the Rat King.
No, Gary! Ugh.
I can imagine him down there, sobbing to himself as he glues the rats together. Hopelessly conflicted by his simultaneously gutless and gentle nature, muttering apologies, making the sculpture of a lifetime. Daphne sees the Rat King, and she decides to vacate the Adelphi Street apartment. And though Gary has to wait his turn, he is patient, and eventually, the sun shines on him again, and he does get to move back to his garden. Though, one might argue it is only because of Daphne and me and this podcast that he's so moved to contact Jade and reprise his status. I remember the way I catch Gary looking at Daphne in the garden that day. Now I get it. He recognizes that his problem has been solved. He's back where he wants to be, with his prized Japanese maple. But Daphne's problem, the one he helped sculpt, is not solved, but is festered and turned malignant. I couldn't put my finger on it then, but now I see it, clear as day. It is remorse on Gary's face. It is remorse for his role in Daphne's torment.
How about the white rats in LA? What's the explanation for them?
I don't know. Maybe Phoebus was leaving them for me. Maybe it was coincidence.
But the Rat King? Gary leaves it in the tunnels. What guarantee is there that you'll decide to dig under those pavers and find it?
I don't know. I guess it was meant for me, one way or another. I guess, one way or another, I was going to find it.
And that's it? You're okay with that?
I think I have to be.
Daphne takes a pause. One of her loaded pauses. I wait. It feels like we have a little time to wait. A little grace to wait. Then she just says,
I should get the kids home. Let me know if you need anything else.
She's just leaving the park, but there's something else in there too. Let me know if you need anything else. The subtext of being let down easy. We're breaking up, or at least taking a break. It's sad. And I'm a little haunted, watching Daphne walk away, with her kids racing ahead and falling behind her. Maybe Daphne's at peace with the ambiguity. And who am I to argue? But I can't help worry how long that peace will last her. Phoebus will be sentenced, and inevitably, he'll be free again. Maybe this is over for Daphne. Maybe it isn't. Europe finally opens up to vaccinated Americans that summer. I make my way to France and then Spain. Every pore of my body hungrily drinks the sounds and the smells of the busy world. Being amongst people again is truly exotic. And I feel a strange projection of melancholy, a kind of preemptive nostalgia, knowing that there will be a time in the near future when this present joy will have already become my past. Before I leave Madrid, I wander through the impressive collection at the Museo del Prado and find myself in front of the Garden of Earthly Delights, as if by accident, though I'm sure not. The work is both larger and smaller than I ever thought it could be, dealing in tiny, binding detail a broad, sweeping account of humanity. I understand why Daphne remembers it so well. One thing is for certain, the painting captures the brutal complication of what it is and has always been to be human. For Phoebus, for Gary, for all of us. Maybe paradise and hell are nothing more than the possibilities that live within us. In the middle panel, our garden, where we partake of the ignorance that either of these possibilities exist in us at all. I think to send Daphne a postcard, but then decide against it. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there.
What's a mouse's favorite game?
I forget.
Hide and squeak.
The Rat King is a production of The Shrill Collective. It was written by L.R. Wilde, directed by Chelsea Feltman and Ash Croce.
Audio engineering and sound design by Brando Kress.
Production assistance by Christina Cole, Allison Wilkes Borland, and Linda DeFuria. Cover art by Samantha Farello. Featuring the voices of Stephanie Lavadera, Kelly Grego, Daniel Van Thomas, Fernando Vieira, Karen Levan, Richard Fisher, Dina Laura, Cherie Wishard, Al Pagano, and Rachel Feltman. The music was written, recorded, and arranged by Chelsea Feltman, Brando Kress, and Tim Leonard. Special thanks to Tim Leonard, Wes Borland, Max Zimbert, Monique Morgan, Laura Annister Walters, Maureen and Robert Croce, Rachel Feltman, Tessa Fay, and Tay Birch. If you or someone you know is being stalked, or is a survivor of domestic or sexual abuse, help is available. Go to stalkingawareness.com for victim resources and information. This and other information is linked in the show notes.